It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Simple treatment records a lot of times don't address what your functional deficits are, so it actually takes a doctor sitting down and giving an opinion as to whether you can walk, whether you can lift weights, whether you can stay at a workstation, whether you can do these types of activities that are required in almost every job.
Private attorney Jerry Lutkenhouse explains what you need to know to increase your chances of winning a Social Security or SSI disability claim. And if the Social Security Administration pays you benefits to which you're not entitled, you'll find out what to do about it during this week's question and answer. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 80, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. U.S. banks may expand their short-term lending at interest rates of 120% or more as they seek to replace more than $15 billion in lost revenue because of regulations limiting overdraft fees. Fifth Third Bank Corp., Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank Corp., and other banks already are making such loans, usually from $100 to $500, at annual rates of 120% if repaid in 30 days. They're known as checking advance products. That puts them in competition with payday loan stores, which make loans with similar terms, but the banks don't call them payday loans because it's a very tarnished, negative brand. U.S. banks may lose from $15 to $20 billion when Federal Reserve rules take effect July 1. The rules will prohibit banks from charging overdraft fees at automated teller machines or on debit cards unless a customer has agreed to pay for exceeding account balances. According to Lauren Saunders, managing attorney with the National Consumer Law Center in Washington, getting a short-term high-interest loan from a bank might be worse than going to a payday loan store because a bank has direct access to consumer accounts, meaning its loans will be paid off first, ahead of food, housing, or utilities. In other news, in a report released last month, the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis documents how Virginia has been provided with close to $2 billion from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that has helped over 5.3 million Virginians. The report analyzes the impact and value of four of the Recovery Act's major direct assistance provisions in Virginia and provides spending figures through January 2010. The report finds over $484 million in unemployment benefits helped nearly 230,000 jobless workers, over $307 million for seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities helped over 1.2 million Virginians, and over $1 billion in direct work-related support helped over 3.8 million working Virginians, 9 out of 10 workers in the state's labor force. According to Michael Cassidy, executive director at the Commonwealth Institute, these payments went out quickly to people in need and helped boost consumer spending at the very time the economy needed it. The full report is available at act.virginiainterfaithcenter.org and click on the link to the report. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is deposition. A deposition is the testimony of a witness or a party in a lawsuit that is taken under oath on oral examination. The deposition is taken after notice to the opposing party, and it is not taken in court, but rather in a lawyer's office or someplace outside court. The opposing party has the right to attend, have an attorney present, and ask questions on cross-examination. The testimony is reduced to writing and authenticated, and may be used in connection with the trial of a lawsuit in circuit court. The deposition gives the lawyers an idea of what may be said at trial, and some depositions may be used as direct evidence. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and deposition is this week's legal term of the week.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
Carol from Goochland.
Welcome to the show, Carol. What are we talking about this week?
I have a question about Social Security. I have a daughter who was receiving Social Security since she was a young child. And she is now 19. She recently received a letter which Social Security has claimed to overpay her several thousand dollars, and they want their money. I disagree that she should pay it because she has no clue how much money she's supposed to be getting, and I want to know how to proceed from here to help her.
It's certainly possible that she was overpaid, but what your daughter can do, and should do fairly quickly, is to go down in person to the Social Security Administration office and file what is called a request for waiver of overpayment recovery. And this is an 8-page form that'll take her maybe a half an hour to fill out. And what it does is it asks the Social Security Administration to waive or to forgive the overpayment. Now, to get this waiver or forgiveness, she has to show two things, both of which I think will be fairly easy for her to show. The first is that the overpayment arose through no fault of her own. And as you said, that should be easy for her to demonstrate because she has no idea how this happened. I mean, she was a dependent. She was a child. She was getting these checks. Then the overpayment was not her fault at all. It was the fault of the Social Security Administration that, you know, should know who to pay and how much to pay. The second thing she has to show is that it would be a financial hardship or otherwise would, quote, defeat the purposes of the Social Security Administration to require that the overpayment be repaid. And again, that should be fairly easy for her to demonstrate. She's 19 years old. I assume that she's not actually out making money and earning, you know, $40,000, $50,000 a year. You know, she may be a student or maybe working part-time. The point is her finances would not permit her to make a repayment in full or even in part of this overpayment. And these types of waivers are pretty readily granted in circumstances like this. The without fault part is going to be so easy to demonstrate, and I think that the financial hardship will be easy as well.
Awesome. I really appreciate that you've given me some clarity. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Take care. We're here in the West End with private attorney Jerry Lutkenhouse. He focuses exclusively on Social Security, disability, and workers' compensation law. Jerry is a former legal aid attorney, and we're happy to have him on the show to talk about how to win your Social Security disability case. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Good afternoon.
Jerry, the first thing I want to talk about is what is meant by Social Security disability? I know you have to be totally and permanently disabled to get benefits under the program. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, that's a good question because a lot of people confuse Social Security disability with like short-term disability. You actually have to have a disability that's going to last for more than 12 months, and it's the doctors are going to have to endorse that fact that it's going to last more than 12 months. So it can't be a disability that's going to last 90 days or a disability that's going to last 6 months. It actually has to be something of a more permanent nature.
And you mentioned the doctors have to endorse that. And I gather that medical evidence is important here. What type of medical evidence do people need in order to be able to have a good case for Social Security disability?
Yeah, one big practical problem is that a lot of claimants lack insurance and lack a way to obtain medical evidence. But it's so important in a Social Security case to be seeing a doctor and being treated by a doctor, and so that doctor can render an opinion based on the treatment. And The length of treatment can establish or buttress the doctor's opinion. So the longer the doctor has treated you, the stronger the doctor's opinion can become. So even if you don't have access to insurance, there are some other ways to get medical care, such as the VCC program at MCV. But you really have to be being treated by a doctor in order to have any chance to for success in a disability case.
And it seems almost like a catch-22 because in our country, you either get medical care through the government, like Medicare, Medicaid, or through your employer. And to get Social Security disability, you have to not be working. If you're not working, you have no employer to provide you insurance. You're trying to get the government help, which would get you the government insurance, but before you can get the government insurance, you have to prove the disability. You need the medical evidence, but you have no employer-provided medical care. It seems like an endless cycle of a catch-22. How do people break that cycle? You mentioned some possible sources of free care.
Right.
What else do you recommend that folks do?
There are certain free clinics that will provide some care. The problem there is that with the free clinics, you're probably going to see a different doctor every time. One of the best things to do is, if one can do this, is to go down to the Medical College of Virginia and try to enroll in what's called their VCC program. That is a program that provides free medical care for people who are eligible under their guidelines. That's one way, and they will assign you to a family doctor, and if the family doctor recommends you to see a specialist, then you can see a specialist through that program. And that's probably the best way of, if you have no insurance and no way of getting to medical care. The other thing, of course, if you have a mental health program, there are mental programs in each county and city that will provide some free mental health care to you. So you should certainly avail yourself of those programs also.
Now, you mentioned mental impairments as well, and I'm glad you did because I understand that the impairment can be either a physical impairment or can be a mental impairment. It can be a combination of the two, but I gather in all cases, whether it's physical or mental, you've got to have medical evidence to document it.
Right, and a particular problem with mental impairments is that you cannot just usually rely on a family doctor for that. You actually have to see a mental health professional, such as a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And typically, if you're alleging a mental impairment and you don't have that, you can be sure that Social Security will have you evaluated by their psychologist, and that evidence may be used to defeat your claim. So it's with a mental impairment, you'd really have to either be seen and being taken care of by a psychologist or a psychiatrist have any chance to prevail on a mental impairment.
Now, you mentioned Social Security might send you to their own doctor, whether it's a psychiatrist or a psychologist or possibly even a medical doctor. Do you find these examinations to be fair, to be thorough, to be accurate, or do you find flaws in them?
On the physical side, they will send you to an internist, and the internist will give you a general physical examination, and they do kind of do a cattle car type process where they run you through for a quick physical examination. So depending on what your physical impairment is, and they can easily miss the problem. So the physical examinations tend not to be very useful. Occasionally, with a mental impairment, you will get a good report from a psychologist on a mental impairment. I find that those are somewhat more helpful than the physical examinations. The physical examinations tend to usually be routinely bad.
And why do you think that is? Is it because they're just not paying these doctors enough money to do these examinations, or they're doing too many in a day?
Well, one example would be if you have a chronic pain situation and the doctor is just seeing you one time and for 30 minutes, a 30-minute physical examination, it's very hard to examine a person for a chronic problem that they're only seeing you one time for just 30 minutes. And if you can walk and you can get on the examining table, get off the examining table, the doctor may very well conclude you're not disabled. Whereas after you do that, you go home and you have to climb immediately into bed because you're in so much pain, but the doctor obviously doesn't see that.
So it sounds like the continuity of care and the length of the, I guess, relationship between the doctor and the patient sounds very crucial in a case like this.
Yes, and as I said earlier, if you have a pattern of being treated by a treating doctor over a period of time, that pattern of care will trump the one examination by a Social Security doctor. So even though you do have an adverse physical examination by a Social Security doctor, if you have a doctor who has treated you over a long period of time, that doctor's opinion will usually be considered to have more weight than that of the one-time examination by a Social Security doctor.
Now, how severe does an impairment have to be? I mean, surely you don't have to be housebound, bedridden, or anything of that nature. But a lot of people think that, well, if I can't do my past work, I'm disabled. And I gather that's not the law for Social Security disability.
What Social Security does is Social Security has a range of age factors. From 0 to 49, you're considered to be in the young category. In the young category, you do have to almost rule out, have an impairment that rules out every job that exists in the national economy. And so, yes, your impairment has to be very severe. From 50 to 54, your impairment can be less severe. And then from 55 to 59, and that age is considered approaching retirement age, in that particular category, you may be able to have a less severe impairment that just prevents you from doing your past relevant work. But that also would depend on your skills and education. If you're an unskilled person and you're over 55 and you can't do your janitorial work because of a leg impairment, arm impairment, or something of that nature, that may very well qualify you for disability, even though you might be able to do other work if you're younger.
So it sounds like your age is an important factor. What about your education?
Right. That's the example I just gave is a janitor who had less than a high school education, age 55, and no longer could do his janitorial work due to some orthopedic impairment. He could very well get disability. But you turn it around and you have a age 55 person who has an orthopedic impairment but has either worked in a secretarial-type profession or has more than a high school education, has skills, and could do other type of sedentary work, that person would have a much more difficult time to get disability, even though they're over 55.
Could you lead us through the process? I know someone goes to the Social Security Administration and submits an application. What happens next? What are the steps they go through?
Yes, the first step is you contact the Social Security Administration, and now you can do it online. The Social Security Administration has an online thing where you can fill out everything online, or you can contact the local office, your local Social Security office. They will require you to fill out a number of forms, including functional capacity evaluation and activity evaluation and a list of all the doctors who treated. Then what Social Security will normally do, Social Security will contact those healthcare providers and obtain all your records. And then using all your records plus the activity sheets and other forms you filled out, they will then reach a determination. And at the initial level, claimants are successful anywhere from 30% to 35%, just based on those treatment records and based on, you know, their age and whatever they have submitted. And that completes the initial step.
What happens after that? If you don't like the result, what do you do?
Okay, after that, you'll get a decision in the mail, and if it's a denial, you have 60 days to appeal, and the appeal will go back to that same Social Security office. And the only difference between the second step and the first step is that the second step will be done by a different official at the local Social Security office, and that different official will again review it. And then, of course, you have a right to submit any new information you might have, and then they will issue what's called a reconsideration. Generally, nationwide, the reconsideration step only approves about 3-4% of cases. So there's a movement afoot to get rid of the reconsideration step, since it's kind of a rubber stamp of the first step, but has not been done at this stage.
And I gather these are all paper reviews. There's no face-to-face hearing. When's your opportunity for that?
Okay. If you then lose the reconsideration, then probably the most important step in the process starts. You have a right to request a hearing again within 60 days after you get the reconsideration, and then you request a hearing, and then instead of the file goes out of the local office and goes to a hearing office where there are a number of what's called Social Security judges, and your case will be assigned to one of them, and you will get a hearing in front of a Social Security judge, at which time you will get a chance to testify and bring in any new evidence you might have to disagree with the reconsideration decision. And that is, generally speaking, nationwide, you have a 40% chance without an attorney to win that kind of case. With an attorney or representative, your chances to win nationwide statistically goes up to about 60%. So it's good at that stage, if you have not already gotten a representative, to get a representative, because your chances of prevailing have gone way up.
And finally, when someone is preparing to go before one of these Social Security law judges, whether it's by themselves or hopefully with a private attorney assisting them, what should they do to prepare for the hearing?
It's very important to work with your treating doctor. Hopefully you will have a treating doctor who is sympathetic and will spend the time with you to write a comprehensive report as to why you're not able to work anymore. And it may be more than one doctor. You may have to be dealing with your representative or attorney will assist you on this, trying to get the type of evaluation that's going to be needed, because simple treatment records a lot of times don't address what your functional deficits are. So it actually takes a doctor sitting down and giving an opinion as to whether you can walk, whether you can lift weights, whether you can stay at a workstation, whether you can do these types of activities that are required in almost every job. So to the extent that that can be done, that is probably the most important part of the puzzle in getting a comprehensive report from a treating doctor who has an established relationship with you over a period of time.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with private attorney Jerry Lutkenhaus, who was formerly a legal aid attorney and is now in private practice, focusing exclusively on Social Security disability and workers' compensation. Thank you very much, Jerry, for being on the show.
And thank you for having me.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Do poor rental housing conditions allow you to withhold your rent, or will that get you evicted? Join us next week when Steve Dickinson, the incoming executive director at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, guides us through what tenants must and must not do to get bad rental housing repaired by landlords in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on December 19, 2008. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.